Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Hello and thank you for joining us on this edition of Africa Link. I'm Crispin Wakideo in Bonn, Germany. A glimpse of our main stories. The missing Nigerian schoolgirls have been in captivity for 100 days. We get the mood in the country.
I mean, it's a mood of despair. People are deeply worried. This is 100 days, you know. Reports say that some of these girls have died of illnesses. We've had about 11 parents dead.
Condoms have been known to reduce the risk of contracting HIV. But in Ghana, the number of those practicing safe sex is diminishing.
I don't like using condom because I don't really enjoy sex using condom.
I wouldn't even want him to use a condom because we are actually not doing anything out from outside.
And we shall also go behind the headlines in South Africa to find out why South African white farmers are concerned about a new proposal for land redistribution.
You can't take half the assets of a business and give them away for free. You know, why don't they pick on the steel industry or the IT industry or retailers? Or why pick on the farmers?
These stories and more right after this.
Top story.
First stop, Nigeria, where twin blasts have killed scores of people in the northern city of Kaduna on Wednesday. The attacks are a stark reminder of Boko Haram's insurgency as they continue to hold more than 200 schoolgirls in captivity. Wednesday marked the 100th day since the girls were abducted from Chibok. In a moment, we shall hear about the mood in the south of the country. But now, here's Alamin Mohammed with this report from Gombe, northeastern Nigeria.
Since the kidnap of these girls, dozens of them have escaped from Sambisa Forest, where they are being held captive, but more than 200 of them still remain in captivity. Their detention by Boko Haram insurgents over a period of months continue to cause concern not only for Nigerians, but also for the international community. This Wednesday, it is 100 days since the kidnap of these students, yet they have not been rescued, despite the public protests that greeted the incidents within and outside the country. It was a day of prayers as Muslims and Christians gathered at different worshipping centers to pray for the release of the over 200 abducted girls in Chibok. Malam Sani Yakubu, a political analyst, described the day as a mourning day not only in the north but the whole country.
We are just in mourning because we have not up till now seen any tangible evidence that the federal government is willing to bring back the girls. Therefore, we are still in mourning and we will not be pessimistic, we are optimistic, but up till now we have not seen any sign of positive reaction. There is nothing on ground to show that they have either located the children or they are ready to bring them back. And virtually some even hunters come out with their own weapons and says if government will give us necessary support, they can easily rescue the girls. And I have the belief the hunters can do it if the government can easily support them.
Umar Adamu of Political Science Department, Gombe State University, says Nigerians are losing confidence in their leaders.
How could on earth, for over 100 days, more than 200 girls will be abducted and the Nigerian government is not doing anything to rescue them? People have lost confidence in the government. That is the motto. The impression that people have is that the government have failed in their responsibility for protecting life and properties, more especially in northern Nigeria.
At the peak of the initial condemnation of the federal government's effort to rescue the girls, which prompted the Bring Back Our Girls campaign on the social media, the government eventually said it was going to seek international assistance on the rescue mission. It took the presence of Pakistani girls' education campaigner Malala Yousafzai to convince Jonathan of the need to speak with the parents of the Chibok girls, an effort that created another controversy of its own. The meeting attracts wider condemnation from northern part of the country. This is what both Umar Adamu and Sani Yakubu said about the meeting.
I don't think if that meeting will make any impact or how will it give confidence to parents and people in northern Nigeria. The meeting will not change anything.
Since the problem has started, he must have developed that courage to go and see them, but he couldn't do that until the visit of Malala. So it's a shame, it's a shame. And the meeting couldn't have even taken place until he has made a necessary effort to bring the girls.
The initial reaction of the Nigerian government to the kidnap of these girls was one of denial. The blame game between the federal government and Borno State government contributed immensely to the prolonged presence of the Chibok girls in Sambisa Forest. The blame game was the catalyst for the inaction of the Nigerian government over the kidnap of the girls. Fears have been expressed that some of them might have died or been taken out of the country to the neighboring countries such as Cameroon, Chad, and Mali.
Alamin Mohammed in Gombe, northeastern Nigeria. Failure by President Goodluck Jonathan's government to rescue the girls prompted an international campaign which came to be known as Bring Back Our Girls. Abuja, the seat of government, has witnessed daily protests calling on the security forces to do more for their release. 100 days have passed now. Are Nigerian southerners still concerned about the plight of the girls? From Lagos, Samuel Lukoya reports.
Rallies like this have been held in different cities in southern Nigeria as the people from this part of the country campaigned to draw the government's attention to the need to secure the release of the abducted girls. The group Bring Back Our Girls, which is at the forefront of the campaign, urging the government to take action to end their ordeal, has been active in southern Nigeria. Chude Jidonwo, a lawyer, is a member of Bring Back the Girls campaign. This is how he describes the mood in the group 100 days on.
I mean, it's a mood of despair. People are deeply worried, you know, that this is the 100 day. You know, reports say that some of those girls have died of illnesses. We've had about 11 parents dead. You know, the Chibok community is still under attack by Boko Haram. And at the center of it all is these girls that we don't even have any update on what their status is. So there's a sense of despair, but people refuse to lose hope, and that's good.
The last 100 days have been a period of trauma for many in southern Nigeria. Some of the most traumatized are the women's rights activists. Betty Abba, a women's rights activist, is executive director of See Hope.
100 days, they are yet to be found. 100 days, it doesn't seem that the government is committed to bringing them back. It appears more that the government is more interested in whitewashing its own image and securing the lives of these innocent girls. It's a timeless scandal. It's an international shame for Nigeria. And we believe that, we hope earnestly that we'll be able to overcome this nightmare.
The organizers of the campaign to bring back the Chibok girls say their activities will continue. Yomi Shomolu of the Voice of the Christian Matters, an organization involved in the campaign, says the social media and press, which are both quite powerful in southern Nigeria, should be commended for keeping the issue of the girls alive.
The social media has no boundary, so it attracted the international community to the point whereby even Obama's wife too was involved in this campaign. And you know, the media is stronger in the south, in Nigeria, both the print, the electronic, they are all involved in this. And that's why the Bring Back Our Girl campaign is alive.
The Nigerian government says it is doing everything it can to rescue the girls. President Goodluck Jonathan has requested permission from Parliament to secure $1 billion foreign loan to fight the Boko Haram insurgency. But Nigerians are doubtful if the money will be put into any tangible use.
Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Africa Link, every weekday on Deutsche Welle.
Gains here and setbacks there. Former US President and AIDS philanthropist Bill Clinton has told a World AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia, that an AIDS-free generation is within reach. Clinton also said achievements made in the fight against HIV/AIDS should not be an excuse for people to rest on their laurels. He probably was referring to Ghana, which has seen a drop of condom use as a way of preventing the spread of HIV. Isaac Kaleji reports on this worrying trend.
According to Ghana's AIDS Commission, almost 30 million condoms are distributed nationwide every year. This is to help reduce the number of new HIV/AIDS infections among members of the population who are sexually active. In Ghana, just under a quarter of a million people are living with HIV, according to the United Nations figures for the year 2012. Condoms are a tried and tested method of reducing the number of new infections, but the country director of the UNAIDS in Ghana, Germay Haley, told Deutsche Welle, many educated Ghanaians from the middle and professional classes do not use them, preferring to have unprotected sex instead. He says this contributes to the high prevalence of HIV among these classes, even though the prevalence rate across the population has dropped.
One of the reasons that comes up during my discussions with quite a number of them is actually They have never considered HIV as an immediate threat for them. They always considered HIV to be a problem of other people. So therefore, they say they don't use condoms unless it is for contraceptive purposes. And so this shows that there is a high level of misinformation within this group.
To confirm the concerns of Haley, I went onto the streets of Accra. On the streets of Accra, some middle-class men had various reasons why they won't go in for condoms before having sex. These reasons range from ignorance to stigma.
First, I would say going to the pharmacy would be a problem because of a fear factor, and me going there and then they would see my face and then commenting, who am I going to use it for? So I prefer just having sex without going in to get a condom at the pharmacy.
I don't like using condom because I don't really enjoy sex using condom. There's this saying, people say, when you buy toffee, you can't eat toffee while it's in a wrapper. You have to unwrap it.
Using condom in having sex, me for instance, I don't like it because I really want to enjoy my woman.
Some women also prefer to have their partners not put on condom during sex. Anita Kwate is an office secretary, and she believes in having sex without condom. She regards this as proof by her partner of his loyalty to their relationship.
Why should I use a condom when I'm with my guy? I wouldn't even want him to use a condom because we are actually not doing anything out from outside. So that even shows me that he's not doing anything outside.
Female condoms have been available for some years now. It has been challenging promoting their usage among women. Sandra Ofebia works for an insurance company in Tema. She explains why the female condom creates problems for her.
The first reason is that it's too big to use. I don't feel comfortable whenever I use it. Whenever I insert it, I don't feel comfortable. The final reason is that my partners complain about it because it doesn't really help us enjoy ourselves.
Willebek Amwani Chum is a technical coordinator at the Ghana AIDS Commission. He says they are succeeding in encouraging people to protect themselves from HIV infection by using condoms despite various challenges. He describes one of their new strategies to increase condom use among Ghanaians.
So we create avenues where people can get condoms by the non-traditional ways. We've started installing the condom vending machines. These are small portable machines placed at vantage points where people can get easy access to them and will remove the barriers of human interface here and there. So you just go in, just slot your coin, and you have your pack of condoms fallen for your use.
At a major conference on HIV/AIDS, which is now underway in Melbourne, stakeholders have been underlining the importance of bringing down the rate of new infections. Authorities in Ghana are hoping they can address the challenge with increased condom use.
Isaac Kalechi in Accra. You're listening to Africa Link, Deutsche Welle's English for Africa service from Bonn, Germany.
Behind the headlines.
It's no secret that some of Africa's conflicts are a result of land ownership disputes. In South Africa, land reforms remain a sensitive issue 2 decades after the end of apartheid. The white minority still holds 87% of commercial farmland. A new proposal on land redistribution by South Africa's ruling ANC has white farmers on edge. As Subri Govender reports, some of them are considering relocating.
Clearly hasn't been thought through very clearly, and it's just not going to work. You can't take half the assets of a business and give them away for free. You know, why don't they pick on the steel industry or the IT industry or retailers? Well, why pick on the farmers?
That's Murray Jackson, a 53-year-old third-generation sugarcane and poultry farmer. He's been in charge of the family-owned farm for just over 25 years. The more than 100 hectares of land lie on a hilltop in the KwaZulu-Natal province of South Africa. The farm was developed more than 110 years ago by Murray's grandfather, who migrated from England in the early 1900s. Today, Murray provides employment and shelter for about 70 farm labourers and their families. He says he will not expand his farming business because of all the uncertainty and insecurity around land ownership in South Africa.
You know, the environment in Southern Africa or South Africa is not conducive to farming. Guys are going north. Plenty of development going up in Mozambique. And I've been to Mozambique and had a look at it. I believe, and I haven't been to Zambia, Kenya, up north. Lots of guys are going, and they're doing very well.
After visiting Murray Jackson, I drove another 200 kilometers north to meet another farmer, Rex Talmage, in the far rural district of Gingenslovu. 42-year-old Rex is a fourth-generation farmer who, with two brothers, is in charge of more than 800 hectares of sugar land, which provides employment for several hundred workers. Rex supports the process of land redistribution, but says there are a lot of open questions.
Some proposals that come forward are largely impractical. Some are largely unsustainable.
Commercial farmers in South Africa are represented by a number of organizations. A spokesperson for the Sugar Association, Tandewaka Sibiya, told me that they believe South Africa's history of land dispossession has to be corrected, but this must be done within a legal framework.
We do recognize that South Africa has a past and we have a particular history of land dispossessions that need to be corrected, and therefore we do support land reform, provided it is done within the imperative of the Constitution, which is a superior law that governs everything in this country.
In the view of the government and the ruling ANC, land reform must take place to satisfy the needs of the majority of the people. Tandi Modise is the chairperson of the National Council of Provinces. She had this to say about land redistribution.
It is a fact that black people are trying to acquire as much land as they can. It is not a sin. It is a fact that there is some provision in the Constitution which should enable the state to take land and to put in programs which will benefit the many.
Altogether, there are more than 39,000 white commercial farmers in South Africa. Prior to 1994, when apartheid was still in force, there were more than 50,000. Now, farmers like Murray Jackson fear that the constant talk by people such as Julius Malema that land should be confiscated without compensation will only lead to greater uncertainty among them. They fear that more farmers will leave the country, with the result that South Africa could find itself in the same situation as Zimbabwe. Namely, that a country that once produced food for the entire continent finds itself reliant on imported food for its survival.
That report was compiled by Subri Govender. Breakthrough in Brazzaville. According to a tweet by the African Union, Seleka rebels and anti-Balaka militants have agreed to sign a ceasefire agreement. At the time of this broadcast, the signing, which was to be done in Brazzaville, capital of Congo, where a peace summit on CAR had been going on since Monday, had not taken place. But does the ceasefire agreement mean the summit was a success? I put that question to David Smith, director of Okapi Consulting and an expert on Central African Republic.
Well, when you put it in those terms, Crispin, I'd have to say yes, although the bar was set rather low for such things. One of the hopes of the gathering was that a ceasefire would be agreed to. And Seleka has, after much back and forth and a lot of fear that they wouldn't, has indeed signed a ceasefire agreement. Although reports coming out of Brazzaville say that it's a ceasefire agreement with conditions. Seleka has apparently been asking for more positions within the transitional administration interim government in the Central African Republic. It's not clear yet what, if any, concessions have been given to Seleka. But the fact that a ceasefire agreement has been signed is certainly good news. I have to say, however, in the same breath, that ceasefire agreements signed by Seleka in the past have not been respected for very long. So we'll have to wait and see what happens on the ground in the CAR.
But did this ceasefire come as a surprise? I mean, it's only on Monday when the Seleka leader Musa Dafane said that a partition between the north and the south is needed in CAR before talks with the Christian anti-Balaka militants can proceed. Would partitioning the country help end the conflict anyway?
To start with the last part of your question, would it help? A resounding no. I think When General Moussa Dafan makes the statement that partitioning of the country is a precondition, I think that's just bargaining to get more power for Seleka. It has come out of Brazzaville as well that Seleka, at least for the time being, dropped the condition of partition as a condition for signing the ceasefire agreement. Having said that, I think it's important to note that whether or not Seleka pushes for partition, de facto partition exists already. There is a line drawn across the country that goes through places notably like Bambari in the middle of the country, where everything to the northeast of Bambari is de facto in the hands of Seleka, and everything to the southwest of Bambari is de facto in the hands of Antibalaka. So whether or not Seleka says it drops its call for partition, that partition is in fact there. It's not a good thing. The peacekeepers of the African Union-led mission MISCA, of the French forces Sangaris and the European forces, and later on the United Nations peacekeeping mission, which will be deployed in September, MINUSCA, are all of the opinion that the Central African Republic is one sovereign state which cannot be divided. It's rather odd that a group of rebels known as Seleka has the power to be able to at least attempt to convince the international community that the Central African Republic should be divided, because Seleka doesn't represent a majority of Central African opinion. It represents a minority. It's my opinion that the only way Seleka can possibly believe it has the ability to convince the international community and anybody else that's listening that it should be taken seriously is because it has support from outside of the Central African Republic. People who follow this story very closely fear that much of what Seleka does is driven in foreign capitals, notably the capital of Chad and N'Djamena, and to a lesser extent the capital of Sudan, Khartoum.
Talking of Chad was more or less sidelined in this peace summit, and we know how much influence, as you put it, it has in Central African Republic. Was that a mistake to lock Chad out of these talks?
I think the Chadian president, Idriss Deby, is being very careful at the moment for a variety of reasons. He knows that there's a UN panel of experts examining Chad's alleged role in the Central African Republic conflict as we speak. It's in his interest to maintain a rather low profile. He's also riding a wave of support from Western nations, notably France. Only a few days ago, France announced that it was going to base its new Africa command in N'Djamena, its new command, its new grouping called Barkhane, which to some extent is replacing Operation Serval in Mali and regrouping various French forces under one Chadian-based command. Something else to take note of here, Crispin, is that Denis Sassou Nguesso, the president of the Republic of Congo, where the talks have just wrapped up on the Central African Republic, sees Idriss Deby as a rival as far as importance in local leadership in Central Africa is concerned. So it's no surprise that Denis Sassou Nguesso would want to keep Idriss Deby at an arm's length. But as I said earlier, Mr. Deby's keeping a bit of a low profile right now, knowing that his country is under investigation for what it may or may not have done in the CAR.
I was talking to David Smith via Skype in South Africa. And for more on that story, log on to dw.de/Africa, where you'll find the full interview and other African stories.
Opinion.
Let's return to Nigeria for this week's opinion. On several occasions, the authorities have insisted that they know the location where the Chibok girls are being kept by Boko Haram. Take a listen.
The issue of Chibok girls is government is taking efforts, making efforts. We know where they are, but we don't want to endanger their lives. That is the truth. We want to take it gradually and release them at the appropriate time. We know where they are.
Ita Ekpeyong, head of Nigeria's State Security Service. The question we want to pose is, should the Nigerian government disclose to the public the location of the missing schoolgirls? Send us your say, either by text message on +491609575910, an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. And as always, before we go, a reminder of our main stories. Twin blasts in Kaduna, northeastern Nigeria, have killed at least 80 people. Central African Republic Seleka rebels have agreed to sign a ceasefire agreement at the close of a peace summit in Congo, Brazzaville. We've also been hearing about a drop of condom usage by Ghanaians as the World AIDS Conference continues in Melbourne, Australia. And that brings us to the end of the show. Thanks for being such good company. Africa Link returns same time tomorrow. From me, Crispin Makideu, and the entire crew, peace.